Om Agyanatimiran Tasya Gyanam Jana Shalakaya Chakshurun Lilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, day three, which was, why do devotees need to adopt Vedic culture? Well, the straightforward answer is because it helps us to be Krishna conscious. We should accept everything that is favorable for advancement in Krishna consciousness and reject everything unfavorable. Yeah, you have to pitch your voice so that it's just loud enough so everyone can hear, and no louder. All the Russians can hear. That's all. The non-Russians on this side don't need to hear. Vedic culture is that which helps us to be Krishna conscious. In Varnashram or Vedic society, as in non-Varnashram society, the activities of eating, sleeping, mating and defending go on. But in Vedic society they go on in such a manner that they are conducive to liberation or elevation and ultimately towards Krishna consciousness. Now, one reason, I'll come to that later. An example I often think of in relation to Vedic culture, how it helps and protects us. It's something like an artist walking on a tightrope. You know, they have, in the circus, they have a high tightrope and he walks along it, and maybe he's juggling at the same time. So it's a dangerous thing. Now, if he falls down, he breaks his neck. Or if there's a net underneath, he doesn't break his neck. He falls down and he can get back up again. So Vedic culture, at the least, can be considered like the net. I'll explain this. When we're practicing Krishna consciousness, we can fall at any time into materialistic activities. Or we can fall from the standard of devotional service. It's intense to perform pure devotional service, or by that I mean the activities of sadhana bhakti. The endeavor to be a pure devotee is intense. Practically from the very beginning, when one takes up pure devotionals, when one takes up Krishna consciousness, especially if he comes in a proper sampradaya and under a proper guru, just like we see how Prabhupada is always pushing his followers to be fully Krishna conscious. Although Prabhupada would He didn't force, but his pushing was towards pure Krishna consciousness. That he tried to engage his followers, his disciples, in such a way that they'd be come to the standard of a haitukiya pratihata, non-stop, unmotivated to pure devotional service. So, even in the beginning of sadhana bhakti, one is engaged in pure devotional service in the sense that one is thrown into that. Now, especially if you join a temple, then, like I say, there might be some concession, but basically the atmosphere is one is in which one is expected to just fully serve Krishna purely all the time. On the other hand, the consciousness is not there. The activities may be there, but the consciousness is still contaminated in so many ways and still affected in so many ways by our previous material conditioning. So due to that consciousness and due to material attachments which still reside in the heart very strongly, even someone who's practicing on the level of pure devotional service, they can slip from that standard quite easily. That's why we always have to remain very intensely engaged in Krishna service and always in the association of devotees. But even then we see that even as Prabhupada writes, even stalwarts on the path. Stalwart means like a great, very strong hero. That's an approximate approximate meaning. Someone who appears to be very staunch, yeah. They may slip because Maya is very strong. Now, someone whose background culture is one of meat-eating, illicit sex, gambling, and intoxication. When they slip from Krishna consciousness, then they tend to slip back right back into that. Whereas someone who's from a culture where they've never known such things, then even before coming to Krishna consciousness, they don't feel like eating meat, drinking wine, having illicit sex, all these things, because they've never known such things, and they have no attraction to such grossly. I mean, in the heart, that attraction is always there. They have no such training, so their culture is such that they're not accustomed to such activities. So even if they fall away from pure devotional service, they're not likely to fall so badly into gross sinful life. Prabhupada writes in his purport to the famous Bharata Bhumite Hoila Manusha Janmaja, this verse. He says that even now people in India are afraid of illicit sex. They're afraid of meat eating, they're afraid of gambling, and they're afraid of intoxication. Prabhupada was writing in the 1970s. Now times have changed. The culture is being deliberately changed. I was just told this afternoon. Vasugosh Prabhu, my God brother, told me that now some Times of India or MTV or something, they're in all the big cities, they're interviewing young girls, means college going age, to become members of a rock band. They want to make an Indian women's rock band. I think they're imitating like in the West, and there's tremendous competition to become a member of this rock band. In other words, they want the traditional Indian womanhood, which was based on Sita, Damayanti, Savitri, Madri, Kunti Devi, all these great famous women. Forgotten, but they want to make them absolutely like in the West, where, in Prabhupada's word, all prostitutes. Prostitute in the sense that they have no moral standard, and they're just loose and free and cheap and destroying the whole moral fiber of society and just making illicit sex a normal thing, as it is in the West. Didn't used to be, even a few years ago. Illicit sex was frowned upon in the Western countries. Now it's considered completely normal. But previously, even now in India still, to some extent, that culture is going on. But that protects us from fall down if we're practicing devotional service, and it helps us to come into devotional service. That people who are from the very beginning accustomed to chant the names of Krishna, then they can very easily take up Krishna consciousness. It's among traditional Indian people, which are a vanishing species practically, but it's not a major cultural change to take up Krishna consciousness as it is in the West. Just like I remember Amitabha Prabhu, he told me when he was practically kidnapped and put on a traveling bus party, he met devotees in North India, and their traveling Sankirtan party, Western devotees who had come to India, and he showed some interest. They practically forced him on the bus and drove off with him. So, and then they locked him in a room and said, "They're not allowing you out until you read this whole Bhagavad Gita as it is." And various things like that. So then they wanted to teach him how to put on tilak, and said, "Well, this is what you're doing here." And the Manju said, "I know." He said, "How do you know? You only just joined us." He said, "Well, I'm a Hindu. I was brought up with this." They were amazed. How could anyone know without being shown? But he comes from such a background. He knows. So that culture is so valuable because it, just by being in this culture, if we're brought up in this culture, then we're already just on the basis of that, we're already so much advanced. Prabhupada said that again. He said that everyone is in India is Krishna conscious by their culture. By their culture, they're already so much advanced. Whereas in the West, Prabhupada said so many things about that. Just like when, again, talking somehow or other, so many other topics of discussion in the last few days always lead to Tamal Krishna Maharaj. But Bhakti Charu Maharaj, he had just joined actually, and just a few months ago, within a few days, Prabhupada gave him first and second initiation. And then within, I think, 13 months after he joined, Prabhupada gave him sannyas. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj protested, as only Tamal Krishna Maharaj could do. Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and to some extent also Harikesh Maharaj, but it was a different relationship. Tamal Krishna Maharaj protested, how can you do Prabhupada? He's just a new man. And Prabhupada said, he said to Tamal Krishna Maharaj, again, which we shouldn't misunderstand in any way, but he said he's already far more advanced than you from previous births. Again, there was some occasion on which, I can't remember, maybe one of you can remember, in which Prabhupada said to Garga Muni, these are all, you know, all these other great names from the past, Brahmananda's brother. Actually, he gave class in Vrindavan yesterday, so. Devotee who just came from there told me. Anyway, I can't remember the circumstances under which he said it, but, you know, Garga Muni is an American, New York Jew, sharp, intelligent, good at business. His father's a businessman, all these things. But on some occasion, I can't remember what it was. Maybe he said something about, but Prabhupada said to me, Prabhupada said to him, to me you are a white Negro, or white Aborigine. He was saying something about Aborigine. He said, to me you are a white Aborigine. So Prabhupada really didn't have a very good, he didn't think much of this Western way of life. He wanted devotees to take up the Vedic culture because, and so many things. Now, I know that devotees might think that, you know, myself, I'm a bit of a fanatic or something, because if I see anyone with their hand in their mouth, I'll tell them to go and wash it. And so many different things. If one of my disciples treads on my shoes, I'll tell them you shouldn't do that. If they put their foot on anything which they shouldn't put, which actually you should put your shoes on the floor, and on your own shoes, and then if you're taking or on the seat or like this, but practically you don't put your feet to anything. You don't open doors with shoes. So anything like that, I'll tell. So you may think, well, why am I doing? Why am I saying no one else says these things? Well, I'll tell you one other person who always used to say these things was Srila Prabhupada. He used to instruct these things. Especially in India, Prabhupada said, he said, in India, if the Brajavasis see my Western disciples drinking water and touching their lips, they'll criticize. You see, how can these people be sadhus? They're not even following basic human behavior, which even the people who carry the dead bodies, the lowest class of people, they don't touch their lips when they drink. These people are supposed to be sadhus. So Prabhupada always used to teach these things. I learned many things actually from Jaipataka Maharaj, who used to teach me. And Prabhupada used to teach him, and he so many things. So, and you may think, you know, what's the big thing? What's the difference? You know, touch it to your lips or don't touch it to your lips. What's the difference? But actually, this Vedic culture is very subtle. Whereas Western culture is very gross. It only deals with the gross platform, and gross means what's. It doesn't make any difference to your sense gratification whether you touch or you don't touch to your lips. It doesn't make any difference to your sense gratification or anyone else's sense gratification if you happen to tread on their shoes. That's on the gross platform, but there are so many subtle considerations. There's subtle contamination by touching the. Apart from the hygienic point of view, there's contamination. Certain activities are considered contaminated, in which state you can't. It is very shocking. Sometimes you see devotees, they touch their lips, and then they're in the Bhagavatam, and then they're touching the Srimad Bhagavatam. Actually, yesterday I saw one of a very senior devotee with his in his mouth. He was, for some reason or other, he was. I don't want to say his name, but I was surprised. It's just, you see, that's a common thing people have. True. Another common thing, they take their pen or their keys, say their car keys, they have to open the door, they put it in their mouth. Isn't that a common thing? Or even sometimes I see for turning the pages of the Bhagavatam, lick their finger. One time I saw, it's painful to say, there's a new bhakta. Hare Krishna, he was actually, he was being very clean and tidy as he was cutting his toenails. See, he didn't want to just cut it all over the floor. So, as he was cutting his nails on the Bhagavad Gita. Hare Krishna. Because people don't know, they have no training. And you may think, what's the thing? What's the big thing? It's a book, it's a piece of paper, and you collect it and you throw it away. And that's tidy, clean and tidy, right? Now, how are we to explain what's wrong about that? It may be a little difficult to explain, but just by your groans, I could understand you got the point. It's a subtle contamination. It's subtle, but actually it's a very gross thing to do. But exactly how? Well, yeah, we can explain. To a gross person, you can't explain. But to someone who understands this is a sacred book, you can't do things like that. For someone who accepts that there is something which is sacred. To a materialist, there's nothing sacred. Everything is just there's matter, that's all there is. There's nothing sacred. There's nothing spiritual. There's nothing holy. Everything's just mundane. But to someone who understands that some things are sacred, then you have to treat them very, very respectfully. And a devotee sees everything in relationship with Krishna. So he treats everything very carefully. Even you'll see Prabhupada, sometimes on a morning walk, he's going on a morning walk, and in someone's yard, in their house, the water is dripping, drip, drip, promise, they go and turn it off. So someone's yard, and it's only a little drop of water, who cares? There are so many things, so many times you see someone in the bathroom shaving. And meanwhile, the water is coming out of the tap at full force. And every 20 seconds or so, they stick their razor in there. So for 19 seconds, so much water is coming, they don't think, just turn it off and turn it on again every time. So conscientiousness is required. There's a famous saying of Prabhupada's, I haven't had it authenticated, but even if Prabhupada didn't say it, it's a good saying, that first of all we have to become conscious, then we can become Krishna conscious. You have to become conscious. Before we can be fully Krishna conscious, how does Krishna say to see Him? Rasoham apsu kaunteya prabhashmi shashi suryaya. We see Krishna in the creation. Everything in relationship with Krishna, and Krishna in relationship with everything. So in modern society there's this idea of protect the environment and don't destroy nature. That's good actually, but the perfection of such vision is to see why there's an inherent feeling that nature is divine. That book was made, divine nature. But why is it divine? Because it's in relationship with Krishna. We shouldn't mistreat anything. So that's Krishna consciousness. Treating everything properly. Don't waste anything. Don't unnecessarily spoil anything. Don't mistreat anything. Any person or any living being or anything in creation. So this is Vedic culture. But Vedic culture is not just like we have this New Age idea of protecting the environment, which is good. But they can never properly understand what is the right thing to do. We can never properly understand unless we're guided by Shastra, because from Shastra we get the actual idea of how the universe is going on, why it's going on, and how to act in such a way that our function within the creation will be properly executed. That function is called dharma. Dharma. There's no English translation of this word. Sometimes it's translated as religion. Prabhupada would say it's occupational duties, but the inherent nature. That's another meaning. Dharma in the sense, just like we say, someone's dharma. What is their inherent nature? So the inherent nature of the jiva is to serve. With it, how we live in this world, what is our dharma? Now Krishna says, give up all dharmas. Surrender to me. But actually, even in pure Krishna consciousness, pure Krishna consciousness, which is beyond ordinary worldly dharma. This is a complex discussion, very complex. But even though it transcends ordinary dharma, it's on most levels is not contradictory to it. In other words, you can be the purest, greatest devotee in the world. That doesn't mean that you run the tap at full force when you're shaving unnecessarily. Even then you'll think how to preserve, because you see everything in relationship with Krishna. So Prabhupada wanted us to adopt the Vedic culture, and he introduced many aspects of that even in the early days. Of course, Prabhupada said that as far as dress is concerned, he said once, I never asked them to wear dhoti and sari, but they did themselves. But then he liked, when the devotees start to take those things up, Prabhupada liked that. He wanted that. And then he when it became part of his movement, then he didn't like to see his, in ordinary circumstances, he liked to see his disciples. He was very specific about shaved head so many aspects he taught. Even you see Brahmananda Prabhu, when his mother came to visit Prabhupada in that storefront temple, his mother came and Brahmananda, he hadn't seen his mother for some time. Prabhupada told, bow down. You should bow down before your mother. Because in Indian culture, you see, Prabhupada, he couldn't imagine that the son hasn't seen the mother for so many days, and then she comes and he just stands there. You have to bow down. That's the proper culture. Still, you'll find even today, especially among Punjabis, in many ways they may be very materialistic. Punjabis means people from Punjab, northwest India. There are many in Delhi. And often they're very materialistic people, but you'll find, especially among Punjabis, that every day they'll bow down before their parents. And no, I'm not just talking about little children. The man may be married himself with five children. You know, people don't have five children these days, but two children. They'll come and their parents, they'll come and bow down before them. Do you do that? You do? I think I told you should do.
Yeah, when I came here, I just, my father's kitchen.
Yeah. I think I told you to do that, is it? Yeah. You should continue to do that. So that makes such a nice culture. I've seen also among South Indian Brahmin families, not all of them. Same thing. The young man, he's married, has children, he's earning plenty of money. He'll come and first thing in the morning after everything, bathing and everything, husband and wife will come and bow down before the father and mother, full of patience. You can imagine what kind of atmosphere that makes in the home. Isn't that better than when you get up and then, you know, hey, who's making the coffee this morning? You make it! Isn't it a different atmosphere? I had told you so many times, blah, 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 blah. This is the morning. Early morning. But Vedic culture, one thing is, you don't have discussions like who makes the coffee in the morning. Because for one thing, they don't have coffee anyway, if they're really following Vedic culture. But apart from that, everyone has specific services to do. Nowadays, there's the idea, both man and woman go to work, and then the man has to change the nappies of the baby also, and all these kind of things. But in traditional culture, there's a specific division of work. There are certain duties which men do, and certain duties which women do, and certain duties which, certain ways in which children should behave. One thing is, apart from anything else, apart from making such a nice atmosphere, I think in that Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life book, there was that discussion I had with Brajahari Prabhu, and it finishes up that you see, Brajahari Prabhu says, you see, we have to offer respect to our elders, even, and he said that even my father's enemy, you see, because he's elder to me, when I see him, I have to offer obeisances. So I said, well, enemy, you know, you're talking about culture. He said, well, after all, this is the material world. But still, it's our culture. Even if we have an enemy, if he's senior to me, I have to offer him respect. So, everyone's position is very clear in Vedic culture. One reason that people are so crazy in the modern age, and there are many reasons, I think 95% of Americans, that's... I quoted to Sridhar Maharaj, 70% in the developed countries have some kind of psychiatric consultation or treatment during their lives. And he told me, well, in America that's 95%. So why is everyone so crazy? Well, there are many reasons for that. One reason is that the modern society promotes kam, krodh, lobha. Whereas in Vedic culture, the whole culture is to minimize and eventually overcome kam, krodh. You know these words? Kam means lust. Krodh means anger. And lobha means greed. And what do you see on the television? Sex, violence, and advertisements. That is basically what you see on TV. That means increasing kam, material desire, especially sex desire, krodh, anger, and lobh, material desires, greed, I need this, I need that. So that's one reason why people are so crazy, because as Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita, lust, anger, and greed, they're all interrelated, and they drive you crazy. It makes you crazy. If we have more and more material desires, we actually go crazy. Another reason is that people, there's an identity crisis. People don't know who they are or what they're supposed to be. They don't know, especially in the last generation, gender roles have changed. So men, especially in the modern age, they don't know what they're supposed to be. Are they supposed to be like a tough guy, or are they supposed to be like a soft guy? Our roles are dictated by TV, what we see on TV. For some time there's this Rambo kind of guy, and then the men are supposed to be all tough. But you know, not every man can be like that Arnold Schwarzenegger or whatever. I never learned. Whatever his name is. You know, not everyone can be like that, and you can go around like that, but you know, it doesn't work, because someone's going to come up who's bigger than you and punch you in the face. So people don't know what they're supposed to be or what their role is, and they make their role models based on something that they see on TV or something like that. Everyone needs someone to follow. We interact with others according to role models that we see. Starting in the home, with the children, they emulate, first of all, their parents. They look up to their parents. And the younger children look up to the older children, especially younger sons. They always look up to the eldest son. That's the elder brother. That's the general tendency. But in the modern age, no one knows. It's not defined how you're supposed to behave, what you're supposed to be. They say you can be anything you like. You can have a shaved head, or you can have this Rastafarian locks, or you can have purple hair, or no hair, or... So... People are not sure what they're supposed to be, and they're not sure what's expected of them, what role is expected of them. You don't get that in a stratified society, as in Vedic society. What is your role is very clear. This is how you behave with elders. This is how you behave with equals. This is how you behave with juniors. This is your occupation. This is how you behave as a husband. This is how you behave as a wife. This is how you behave with your sisters. This is how you behave with your mother-in-law. It's all very clear. So people don't suffer from such mental difficulties, and therefore people feel much happier like that. It's an interesting thing. A few years ago, the London School of Economics, which is very prestigious educational institution, two lecturers or professors made a worldwide survey of happiness, which is, it's not directly quantifiable as heat, light, or sound, or any such physical thing is. But they based it on factors just like, do you feel peaceful within yourself? Do you feel satisfied in your home life? Do you feel satisfied with your occupation? Do you have many anxieties? And they had a whole list of questions. And based on this, they did surveys all over the world. And they found that the happiest people in the world are in Bangladesh, in general. India came in at number 5, which surprised me, because modern India, they're suffering from the same. Of course, India's—it's like making a, it's really going. It's just going down so fast. It's unbelievable. America came somewhere in the 30s. Britain came lower, and Russia came something like 70. They said that some countries like Bangladesh, they have no money, but they're happy. Some countries like America, they have money, but they're not happy. And then you get Russia, they have no money, and they're not happy. It's a good place for preaching. The Russian devotees are very happy. But don't mind Russian devotees, but several of my god brothers have noted, they don't have any culture. They're not very cultured. They tend to behave with each other very roughly. Isn't it? The Russian devotees, they have a lot of problems among themselves because of their lack of culture. They tend to deal with each other very roughly. So I've heard. I haven't observed myself. I'm not managing in Russia. My experiences among Russian devotees is that in my dealings with them, I find they're generally very sweet and nice. But you never know what happens when the guru leaves. Everyone's all nice, and then the moment he goes, it may be like that. Anyway, we should take up Vedic culture. As I was discussing the other day with some devotees about the ongoing Hindu-Muslim problems in India. So I was saying to Govinda Maharaj, I just met him here, that actually there's no solution to this. There's no political solution. I mean, if you want to fight, then either all the Hindus have to kill all the Muslims, or all the Muslims have to kill all the Hindus, which isn't, it's not a very good idea, and it's not very practical either. So I said, the only solution is, we have to make everyone Vaishnavas. And then we'll form subcommittees and fight in the subcommittees. But at least we won't be shooting each other and killing each other and like that. I mean, fighting will go on. But it will be more civilized. Culture means how to manage life, which is full of difficulties and full of disagreements and so many things. We've seen a very nice manifestation of culture in the last couple of days, because after the departure of Tamal Krishna Maharaj, because you may have noted that many of the speakers were quite frank. They were saying that actually he was in many ways an impossible person to deal with, and one of his disciples was saying that it was only 6 months ago I started seeing him again. I didn't want to see him for so many years. And another god brother of mine, I just met him here, he just came today. He was working under him for many years, and I said this to him, and he said, yeah, actually he ground me into the dust. He was so heavy. So But then, when he passed away, actually, Dvaita Maharaj, I think he made about 30 seconds, he made his offering. He said, never was there a person who was so much loved and admired and respected by so many people who he drove completely crazy. Something like that.
Huh?
Who disagreed? Disagreed. Was that the only disagreed? Was that what he said?
Yeah.
That was a euphemism. You know what euphemism means? It means when you say something politely. Of course, Dvaita Maharaj doesn't usually speak in euphemisms. But it means, you say something in a mild way, when actually you mean something much more strongly.
Like that. He wanted to speak, but it was lunchtime, so he wanted to make it short.
Yeah.
So he made just one sentence.
Yeah. But then, I mean, it's a fact that, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he was a very heavy person. And many people, in various ways, they weren't happy with him in some ways. But when he passed away, you see, that whatever other feelings might have been there, it was all forgotten. And you see, oh, what are his wonderful Vaishnava qualities? So that is actually Vaishnava culture. Of course, it's better to cultivate that here and now, rather than waiting for someone to pass away. But life is such that it's, we have to live with people, and sometimes you find it difficult to live with people. But Vaishnava culture teaches us how to live with others in the best possible way, so that everyone can gradually become advanced in Krishna consciousness. And another important point about Vaishnava culture, which I didn't mention, is so important, is that avoiding offenses to Vaishnavas. We have to be realistic and not sentimental. It means we have to discriminate, choose our association, but at the same time we should not make offenses. Hare Krishna. I was supposed to speak about family values also. Well, there's so much to be said about that. I mean, family values is not... Although I said some things like the children, they bow down. Not only bow down, they touch the feet of their parents. But it's an intrinsic part of Vedic culture, and it was previously part of cultures all over the world. There was no divorce. There was no... all kinds of things have been going on since time immemorial, but at least it wasn't sanctioned by there's been illicit sex, premarital sex, extramarital sex, all these things have been going on. But it wasn't sanctioned by society, and it wasn't that everybody was doing it. Not at all that it was sanctioned by society, quite the opposite. And, that what's there in traditional Indian society was there in other societies all over the world. That even for instance, if you're not very happy in your marriage or whatever, you don't get on with your spouse, then anyway, there's no question of trying it again. There was a song many years ago, which unfortunately I still remember, but it gives a good example, that a song by Engelbert Humperdinck, which goes, anyway, you don't have to remember. Unfortunately, I have many of these songs stuck in my head after so many years. So, I didn't even like the song at that time, but I heard it so many times. So it says, please release me, let me go. To waste our lives would be a sin. So release me, my lover, and let me love again. So this rock music and everything, pop music, it's been very influential in changing the culture. So, what he's saying is that, it seems reasonable, right? I mean, we love each other, we loved each other, but now I don't love you anymore. So, we shouldn't spoil our lives. Let me go, and I'll love someone else. So, it sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? However, it creates chaos in society. And as a result of such ideas, there is no family life in the Western world. A couple of years ago, two or three years ago, I was I spent a day with Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj and others, but mostly during that day I was speaking to him, because our flight from Moscow to Anapa, South Russia, it was delayed all day. It was supposed to be 8 o'clock in the morning, and it eventually took off about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I spent all day speaking with him. And he was speaking about so many things. And I was talking about family values and this and that. He said, well, many people I speak to in America, devotees, non-devotees, when you talk about family life, they don't know what you're talking about. They have, when you talk about living in a family, they don't relate to it at all, because they never lived in a family. It means that maybe their mother and one sister or brother, and a mother with a variety of boyfriends, one after the other. Maybe married one or two of them in the middle. And more than 50% of, in America, more than 50% of children are brought up without both of their parents. It's a normal thing. But this is actually very, very destructive to society. And we see we have so many social problems because of this. I mean, children, they so much look up to and they rely on their parents. And if they don't have good role models, then they're going to suffer. They suffer so much. And they grow up with a distorted mentality. And it's very difficult for them to be a proper person or a moral person, or to speak of Krishna consciousness. So, family values. It's a basic principle. We're talking about culture. Culture means how a society works, how a society... But society, what's the basic block of society? Is the family. So, without that, unless within our ISKCON, now we're talking about, Prem Bhav and dancing with the gopis and so many things, but unless we have some basic human culture in our society, then, I mean, first of all, how are we supposed to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world? How are we supposed to convince others that Krishna consciousness is a better way of life if we can't even, our devotees can't even live peacefully? The most basic part of human existence, to live peacefully as husband and wife. Oh, that thing I was saying about, that even if you somehow or other you don't get on so well with your wife, as Prabhupada said about his own wife, that actually I didn't like my wife very much. He said several times. He said, actually there was nothing, she was a very nice woman, he said. She was actually very nice, but I was, this is Prabhupada speaking. How inconceivable, we don't know. But he said, I was very demanding. Somehow I didn't know. But he never gave, even he had the order from his guru to preach, but he thought, now I am married, now I have to look after my family. Later he came out. So he set an example like that. Now, I was discussing this matter a few years ago with my eldest uncle, who's now passed away, who's from Ireland, where this culture was going on until recently. So he said, you just have to accept your lot. Your lot, which in this case means your fate, your destiny. If you happen to get, you happen to get into a marriage and you don't, anyway, that's it. And I've seen, even in the Western countries, and I've seen it actually many Irish families, how in many cases the husband, he's like, he works all day, he earns money by the day, and he drinks it at night. And the wife's there with, innumerable children. But she doesn't complain, she just goes on, she cooks, she sews, and she yells at the kids and bathes them, and she just goes on. Mother is supposed to be selfless, completely selfless. Now the idea is that women, they should also enjoy themselves, but they're never as happy as a woman who just gives herself. And what a person that the children, they can never forget. You'll find it every in Bengal, Every man, he may be living in the city and his mother's at home. He has his wallet. Everyone, you'll find there's a picture of their mother. They value so much. But nowadays I see boys, they, when they think of their mother, they feel disgusted actually. They don't, because the mother is, she's a playgirl. And he feels disgusted. So parents should think that you, whatever it takes, the most important thing you have to, that your children, when they think of you, they should be proud. Not that I think of my parents, what a horrible thing that the children, they can't think well of their parents. But actually you should have so much pride and affection that, the children, they want to look up that my father, my mother, they're such great people. They may not be great in the sense that they're great leaders of society. They may be very ordinary people. But to the children, they're great because they've sacrificed themselves for the children. They've trained them. When you do something wrong, you teach them. And they'll appreciate so much. I gave in this Glimpses book also, one Madhva Brahmin was telling me he's so grateful because his father always used to beat him. He beat him and forced him to learn Vishnu Sahasrama. I went in his home and they were having a whole puja and he was going chanting so many mantras, and then after I was speaking to him, he said, actually, I'm very grateful to my father. He forced me to learn all these things. He beat me. If I didn't learn, he would beat me. And then you see, he's all his life, he's going on chanting. He's so grateful that my father didn't let me get away. Of course, if you say these things nowadays, I could be hauled before some committee or something, advocating beating of children. And in general, we don't advocate. But the point is there, that the father took it as his duty. That not, you see, nowadays, let the kids play. Just let them do whatever they like. But that's not kindness. Kindness means to take the trouble to correct them at every step. That is real kindness. And in the beginning you may not appreciate it. Of course, it really has to come from the heart. If you're using your wife or your kids as a vent for your frustration, that's not good at all. That's very bad. That's called marital abuse or child abuse. But if one is disciplining for the sake of improving, then it can be understood. Who's being disciplined, even they may not understand at the time, but in course of time they'll understand that this is being done not out of spite, but out of kindness. So there are so many things to say about family. I mean, our preaching really can't be effective unless we get this family, such a simple thing, but unless and until divorce and remarriage becomes non-existent or just frowned, not part of ISKCON culture, then our movement isn't, we can talk about congregational preaching and book distribution and so many things. I'm not saying to stop them, but it's not actually going to have the proper effect unless our devotees can live as human beings, first of all. Now, another point about family value, we're talking about culture, is that culture is imbibed in the family at first. You see, nowadays someone comes, joins our temple or whatever, and we have to train them how to, at least in the West, you have to train how to wash your backside after passing stool. And even in India, you have to teach don't eat with your left hand and don't eat standing up and so many things. But actually, it's not the business of a guru to teach a disciple to wash your backside and take a bath after passing stool. Guru is not meant for teaching these things. These things are taught in the home. The first training comes in the home. Cultural values are imbibed in the home. That's why the first guru is the mother. Mother. First guru is the mother, yes, according to the Vedas. And that's one of the reasons why Arjuna was protesting that if women are corrupted, then the whole society is going to become corrupted. Because first training in culture comes in the home from Especially, well, in mothers and fathers, they have different roles to play. Mother should be an ocean of mercy and compassion. And the father shouldn't be. He should be very strict. So they get both sides. They get all love, and the father also loving, but in a different way. Very strict. You were telling that why the kids traditionally in India, they're very well behaved, because they know if they make one squeak in the wrong direction, then their father's going to come and be very heavy with them. And they learn that from the beginning. And actually, that's very good. So they get full love on one side and full discipline on the other. Both things there. And now the father also traditionally, like I say, he's not carrying the baby around like they do in the modern age and changing the nappies. A little aloof. He's a disciplinarian. And when the children get older, especially, I mean, he'll especially discipline the sons. So they very much appreciate that. You see, the male nature and the female nature is quite different. So training boys to be like girls and girls to be like boys, it's not a good idea. Boys should be trained to be boys and girls should be trained to be girls. Otherwise you get boys. Anyway, so many things. Now, one important point, marriage is a religious institution. Nowadays they take the marriage, you see, you go to the government office and you register and you're married. But why do you bother? It's only a legal arrangement. Otherwise it's the same as cats and dogs. What's this thing about marriage? It's only in human society. Cats and dogs don't get married. It's a sacred vow before God. It's a vow that we're coming together in the name of God, in the service of God, to live a responsible, and there's another very important point, responsibility. Modern society is based on what do I need to do for my sense gratification? For me, me and me. What's the most important thing in my life? Me. What's the second most important thing in my life? Me. What's the third most important thing in my life? Me. And what's the fourth most important? My wife. Why? Because I use her for sense gratification. And dispensable. I can get rid of her, I can get another one. There are plenty of women walking around like this. So when I'm fed up with her, I can get another one. So there's the whole emphasis is on personal enjoyment. But real human society is based on duty and responsibility. That even if you don't like to do something, even if you don't like it, you do it because it's your duty to do it. You have a responsibility. Once you're married, the father has a responsibility to maintain the children. That is his duty. He has to do that. And in the whole society puts pressure on him to do that. If someone comes to you and says, you know, I'm having a lot of problems with my husband, or I'm having a lot of problems with my wife, and then your friends will say, well, you know what, I'm your good friend, I'll give you some advice. You leave him. But that's not good advice. The good advice is that somehow or other you have to adjust. And it's not that there are not marital problems in traditional societies also, but there'll be elders and the elders in the society or in the family. It's a joint family. It's not just nuclear bomb family where they come together, husband, wife, and one or two children. It's called a nuclear family. And then there's a nuclear explosion and the husband gets blown out of the window and there's no husband anymore. But traditionally, family means extended family. Family means there's your family, means your family doesn't just mean your brothers and sisters and father and mother, but it means your father's brothers and his wife and or wives and their children, and they're all brothers and sisters, where they're cousin brother is the same as brother, and even in the village practically they're all brothers and sisters. That's why I was told traditionally in Gujarati villages that boys and girls from the same village will never marry. Because their relationship is just like brother and sister. So it's a very, very big family. And it's so practical. You see, just like nowadays, you see the wife, there's one woman living at home. And either she goes to work and she's under pressure there and she comes home. And there's no one to look after the kid. So the kid's just, you know, comes home, there's no one there, or she comes home and she's already completely stressed from a whole day, and then she has to do all the housework. And she shouts at the husband because she's completely stressed, and then he punches her because he's completely stressed. And then you have a divorce. Or even if she's at home, then she's just, you know, gazing at the walls and, you know, going crazy. And then she thinks, well, the milkman's coming. You know, he's a nice guy. Why don't I make friends with him? Or something like that. But in traditional societies, the family means that they're... all the brothers live together and there are many children. So family doesn't mean one brother, one sister, something like that. At least six brothers and seven sisters and like this. So they're all the brothers will live together. That means that there are many men and there are many women. So one woman doesn't look after one kid who drives her crazy. The babies drive you crazy. I mean, even you love them, but they drive you crazy because they're 24 hours a day. They're on call. They don't have any timing. They scream generally in the middle of the night, as well as in the day, and it drives you crazy, because that's not the way you can't. It's very difficult to go on like that day after day. But if you have many mothers, it doesn't drive you crazy. You have many kids, but they don't drive you crazy because there are many mothers, and that means the children get affection from many mothers, not just from one mother. And they get looked after by many mothers. And your kid is looked after by all your sisters-in-law also. So it shares out the burden. It's not that you're on call 24 hours a day. So there are so many advantages of this. Plus, you see, there's any problem between a husband and wife. Actually, there won't be so many because the rules are there how to behave. And also, the husband and wife aren't together all the time. They're not together all the time. Even there's only a certain time of day when the men and the women even associate. For one thing, the men are out most of the time anyway, earning money, or even if they're overseeing the fields, they're out in the fields working or whatever. Men and women don't mix up so much. And when they mix up, there are certain guidelines for that. And even young husband and wife, they're there, but they're still the children. They're still with the elders are there. So they can advise them and control them. Otherwise, what happens? You have a young man and a young woman come together. They don't know how to behave with each other. And you know, there's no one to guide them. And they have so many problems. So one time, Jai Veda Maharaj said, the problem in ISKCON is that we don't have any grandmothers. We don't have any grandmothers. That was a few years ago. We have now. So, I mean, they have such an important role in society. Older people nowadays, because they're a nuisance. Old people are a nuisance. You have to look after them like children, and so, you know, so ship them off to some home where they can die. And you don't have to bother about them. Actually, they have a very important role in society. Grandmothers are even more affectionate than mothers, right? Supposed to be. Well, nowadays you'll find grandmothers in mini skirts also. So they have such an important role. All the wisdom they've achieved, they've gained from making mistakes throughout their lives, and then gradually you become somewhat wise. And then when the next generations are making the same mistakes, you can advise them, don't do this, and you should do like that. And they're so much respected because they're respectable. People who have lived a respectable life all their lives, when they get old, they become very respectable. But nowadays you get old people, they've been foolish all their lives, so they're simply old fools. And they can't contribute anything to society. So just let them go off somewhere and die. They have nothing to contribute. But in a society where people live a civilized life throughout their lives, and when people become old, they're very, very valuable, their contribution, their guidance is very valuable. Love. I love you. All this modern idea that your marriage is based on love, but this I love you. I can't live without you. You'll never find in traditional society that these people go, husband and wife, oh, I love you. They won't talk like that. They never talk like that. If you say I love you, that means I don't love you actually. If you have to say it, if you don't need to say it, that means it's understood. If you have to say it, that means it's in question. So all this business of holding hands in public and kissing in public, it's really uncultured. Sex should be a very private thing. It's not something that... It's not something, you know, the public, make a movie of it and kiss in public. All these things are very low class. Anyway, these things are considered revolutionary these days. If we tell that women, they're not supposed to have careers, they're supposed to look after their children. And, you know. Thank you for not jumping up and punching me in the face. Oh, so many things. Even in the Indian colleges, they're teaching all these. Especially in India, there's a very strong program to promote all these things to the girls in the colleges and the young men also. Why are you mistreating your wife? Why are you saying she should stay at home? She should have a career. She should have a life of her own. All these things which they're supposed to. They're just designed. They think it's. See, I'm being very. It's very good for them. They can also have a career and become an admiral in the Navy, and they can also fly a space rocket into space. Of course, most of them just end up working in a factory. But that's not your role. That's not your dharma. The particular body has a certain dharma. So it may be in traditional Indian society there have been great queens who have ruled kingdoms and so many things. But they are great, very special people who did that, as well as being mothers. That's their first role. So if you can do that as well, but generally most people can't. So the whole thrust of modern society is to destroy any good qualities in the human being. This modern culture, so-called, it's extremely destructive of any human values, what to speak of higher values. So we should try to adopt this Vedic culture. And what that is, well, it has to be seen, to be understood to a large extent. One point of culture is when someone's speaking, you shouldn't interrupt, especially when in this kind of formal atmosphere. You should learn that. Now, we are supposed to have discussion, but my time's up. But I guess we could take a few questions. What is it? Till 5:50? 5:50. Oh, okay, so we do have time. All right. Yeah, what do you want to say? A balance between family values and Krishna consciousness. Well, ideally, it shouldn't be so much a question of balance as that the two things go on together, side by side. But modern society, the modern kind of family life is... people are so busy that they don't have time for Krishna. It's very difficult to get enough time to practice Krishna consciousness. That's why Prabhupada emphasized so much we should go to the land. Anyone who's been at this seminar with Tejas Prabhu, he's saying, what is the main purpose of going to the land? Because our main purpose is not to be farmers. That's coincidental. But the main purpose is to save time for developing Krishna consciousness. That is the main purpose. There are many other purposes also, such as living a more sane, cultured way of life. But in traditional societies, we don't have so many needs. We don't need electricity. We don't need gymnasiums. Gymnasiums. In Russian, that means a school. But in English, that means gymnasium means a place where you do exercise. We don't need electric mixers. We don't need TVs. We don't need all these things. We have much less needs. We don't need TVs, telephones. We don't need all these things. So our needs are minimal. We live very simply. And we have time to practice Krishna consciousness. But in modern society, we need a car. We need a phone. We need a computer. These are all necessary. If we're going to live in modern society, practically we need these things. To function in modern society, we need many things. So we have to work to get them. And in modern society, the basic ethic is money. How to get money. So just like this crash, car crash. Why is he driving so fast? Is it just that he enjoys it? That he enjoys risking his life? If he doesn't drive fast, then he gets fired by the company. They'll only keep fast drivers because they want to get as much out of their... They've invested in the car and they want it moving all the time. And they're hired to drive from Calcutta to Mayapur. So if you drive from Calcutta to Mayapur in 3 hours, then you can, after 3 hours, you can engage the car again. If you drive in 4.5 hours, you get the same amount of money. So better you have to have fast drivers. If they don't drive fast, they lose their job. If they drive fast, they may lose their life. That's the pressure. You have to drive fast. Because the whole pressure of modern society, just to get money, 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 money. And it's very much antithetical to Krishna consciousness. How to balance? Well, in your present situation, you'll have to see. I recommend to people that if advancement in your career means you have to spend all your time, which means it does, don't go for it. Be satisfied with a salary which will be enough to maintain yourself. Another thing you can do is try to earn, if you're earning well, is to try to earn enough money that you can save and retire early. These are different things you can do. If you can retire at the age of 30, fine. Retire means live very simply. And maybe have a small business on the side or something, which doesn't take much time. There's a little income. These are different things I recommend to my Grihastha disciples. Or you can try and do some kind of job which won't take up all your time and which doesn't go against Krishna consciousness, just like I recommended to Gaurendu here. That you can teach English, tutoring. And you can be, at least in Gujarat, you can dress in tilak and dhoti and do it. And you can speak to people about Krishna and do it and earn money. So he's doing that and doesn't take all his time. So there are certain ways you can compromise with, or you can live in modern society without being totally sucked into it. But you have to be a little intelligent and plan how to do that. The other thing, the revolutionary thing, is going to the land. But it's also difficult in the modern society, in as much as the economic system is not set up for the small farmer. All over the world, the economic system is set up to favor the big companies. And agriculture is now agribusiness. It's all linked with the modern economic system. So you have to grow certain crops and the seeds come from America and this and that. It's quite complex the way the modern society is set up, but it can be done and it must be done. As far as establishing this culture, where do we begin? Well, we can begin with ourselves. We can try and practice it the best we can, individually. And setting up societies and setting up communities, that's a big challenge. But individually we can start to take up. And at least these values, you see, even if you can't live on the land, you can still have the basic values that I'm not going to watch TV, which is totally contaminating. I'm not going to dump my wife. We can have these values. It does become very difficult bringing up children in the modern age, bringing them up in Krishna consciousness. When they have to go to school and this, it's... They get so much bad association. But it is possible. We have to try the best we can. It's a very, very difficult time. But without this, we can't effectively spread Krishna consciousness very widely or very deeply. We can't be... This is a common mistake that devotees think we'll be Krishna conscious and we'll also be Westerners. We'll have our Western way of life and be Krishna conscious, but the two things don't mix. The Western way of life is meant for going to hell. And the Vedic way of life is meant for going to Krishna. So if we think, you know, we'll have TV and sports and divorce and all this, and we'll be Krishna conscious also, doesn't properly work.
One of your gave us instruction that when new devotees join the temple and ashram, they should also have a feeling of joining to the family, or we should cultivate a mood of family in the ashram and in the temple. Can you mention some important points on how to develop this?
Making a family atmosphere in the temple. Well, Prabhupada told Gurudas, who was married to Jamuna. In those days they were both equally famous. Now Jamuna is more famous. They were the temple presidents of the first temple in London at Berry Place. And Prabhupada said that the temple president should be like a father to the rest of the devotees, and his wife should be like a mother. So they took that very seriously. They looked after the devotees. They used to make sure they had everything they needed, and they'd all sit down together in the evening and take milk together, and they'd read Krishna book to them like this. A lot depends on leaders. Everything depends. Yeah, Kashish.
Я вам сказал, что именно за рабочие дети
Yeah, like Mickey Mouse and Coca-Cola, divorce, Miss World. They already made the Miss World or Miss Universe twice from India. In the Western countries, they're not interested. So now they're making Indians Miss World. Just a few years ago, you couldn't even imagine that a man would allow his daughter to parade herself in front of everyone, half naked. And now they're proud. Oh, my daughter's a model. Film star, Miss World, Miss Maharashtra, Miss Bombay, Miss Villepale. Every locality has their own beauty contest. It's absolutely degraded.
What can do when there's devotees that don't want to abide by Vedic etiquette, but then they want to have association with you? And how could you teach them?
You can't teach someone who doesn't want to be taught. Prabhupada gave the example of you can't wake up a person who's pretending to be asleep. Or as the English saying goes, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. What is my approach? Yeah, it's a difficult one because we're living in a pluralistic society. I mean, ISKCON is a pluralistic society. That means it's not Ekeha Kuru Nandana, it's Bahushakahi Anantascha. There are many different theories about how Krishna consciousness should be practiced. So, what is my personal approach? I try with varying degrees of success to be friendly with everyone. At the same time, I make it known what my position is. And particularly within the circle of those who are interested in listening to me, I speak. If something's really outrageous, I'll speak anyway, whether people don't like it or not, whether they like it or not. And I write books. So that, you know, maybe a couple of generations later or whatever, when all our devotees realize, oops, we went wrong somewhere. What are we doing wrong? Then they, you know, I'll already be, you know, a few more births later, but they can see, here is a book. This is what you're supposed to do. Books are coming. All the details of Vaishnav behavior, books are coming. So that's effective long-term preaching. And even now, you can take up these things. You don't have to wait to get born a few generations later till devotees realize, actually, wouldn't it be nice to follow the Vedic culture that Prabhupada talks about in his books? That, you know, we don't have to have rock and roll in our temples, and we don't have to have professional kirtan music blasted all over Mayapur. We don't have to have all these things. We can have pure Krishna consciousness, and it's the nectar for which we're always anxious. So these are the things we actually have to adopt. And when you get married, there's no one forcing you that you have to get divorced. You can live a whole life with a single spouse, be Krishna conscious. And then the other thing is, when you're old, you have to come out the other side also. That, and then a man, he gets married, he has children, and then after some time, that's another part of the culture. You're supposed to come out the other side. You go into the Grihastha Ashram to come out the other side. You're supposed to take sannyas. So there's so many different factors, and one of my most, my most important role in Prabhupada's mission is to find out about all these things and document them, so that those devotees who want to take these things up can do, at least to some extent, even now. There are many important things. I mean, when we talk about Vedic culture, it's not all. A lot of it's just common sense, which isn't that common. But basic human principles like cleanliness, Vaishnava, Brahmin is supposed to be, Prabhupada said, revolutionary clean. We should be so clean. We have to serve Krishna. Uncleanliness is in the mode of ignorance. Everything should be. So these are some basic things. Cleanliness, proper behavior, knowing how to behave. We should know how to behave. See, we have to know how are you supposed to be. You have a within our material, within our designation that we're in. You see, someone is a brahmachari. Then how do you behave with grihastha men? How do you behave with sannyasis? How do you behave with new devotees? We should know these things. Then it becomes clear. Leaders have to take it up. If leaders themselves chew their counting beads, then you say to someone, "Hey Prabhu, don't chew your counting beads. My guru does." What are you going to do? And gurus especially, they should know these things. Brahmana means he should be a guru. Every Brahmana. Everyone who takes Brahmin initiation should know all these things. Otherwise, you see, if it's just a thread on your body, then what's the meaning? You should know what it means to be a Brahmin.
When a person sees that his elders behavior is not very ideal, what should be his way of looking?
How should one see when his elders don't behave properly? I've written in my upcoming book of Vaishnava Etiquette, there's a whole section dealing with all this different. There's a section on seniority, how to live and act with seniors and how seniors behave towards juniors, correcting others, criticizing others, offenses. It's a very subtle thing. How should you see it? Well, you have to see with two eyes simultaneously. You have to know what is right and what is wrong, and at the same time you have to always respect seniors. Both things go on side by side. It's a very subtle culture. There's also a whole, you know, how to correct others, who are you authorized to correct? Generally a junior shouldn't correct a senior. If it's a serious thing, he may report it to another senior. Or he may be forced to have to say something. How to say it? it requires culture to know how to do that. Recently, one of my godbrothers in a class said something which was, I understood it to be philosophically incorrect and bordering on offensive. But another of my godbrothers in the class asked him for Shastric evidence of this. So then afterwards I wrote some email letter. I worded it very carefully, not to blame him, and using some words like, you see, probably it's probably better not to say this. There are ways of saying things. You can say that, you could say, that this is blasphemy. This is what you said is offensive. Or you could say that, or you can say that, explain that, you know, actually this is, from what we understand from Shastra and our Acharyas, this is the proper understanding, and therefore it's probably better to, and like this. There are ways of doing things and saying things. Of course, one of the things Prabhupada said is that I'm not a probably man. You know what he means by that? Prabhupada is very clear and firm. But that's especially when we're dealing with, when we're preaching and to the public and speaking to juniors. But with seniors, if we have to say something, then we have, which is another reason I'm writing books, because if you write books, then you're not particularly pointing fingers at any particular person. And people may disagree, and they will disagree with so many things. But it avoids making a personal attack. We're talking about the principle, not, we're not accusing the person of ill intent. Our basic premise is that well, as far as we can understand, this is something wrong, but we're not questioning your sincerity like this. So it's a very subtle thing. One also has to have a very good heart oneself. Abraham Lincoln said, and generally we quote from Shastra, but we can quote from anywhere if what is said is true. We quote from Shankaracharya also. He said many things which are true. But Abraham Lincoln said that he has a right to criticize who has the heart to help. If you simply, this is wrong, this is wrong, what are you doing to try to help solve the problem? To help that person to come to a better level? Another thing is before we correct someone, we should make sure that they did something wrong. So many times you say, hey, you did this wrong, and then someone, actually, we may not know all the circumstances surrounding it. There may be a reason why someone did something. We may not be, so it's always, before accusing someone, it's always better to ask that, well, Prabhu, I saw you did this, and you know, it doesn't seem to be right. Why is that? It's different with different people. A guru can chastise his disciples like anything. But among peers, then we should be somewhat careful. At the same time, we shouldn't, if there's something which is not as it should be, in the name of being nice, we shouldn't overlook it. Because we have to do everything properly for Krishna's service. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Yeah, Tanvir Maharaj, this previous seminar, he was showing us this Vedic college, Rupananda Vedic college, that he said. And like he was training up with Vaishnava etiquette and all that. Like in future, I was thinking, like, is that the only way? Because here I found student Gurukul kids and initiated devotees are playing cricket and all.
Yeah, this is all rubbish.
All Brahmin initiated.
I recently visited the Purna Pragya Vidya Pit, the it's a school for Madhva Brahmins in Bangalore. They have a big field out the front, and you see all the Madhva Brahmins with their dhotis up, and they're playing cricket. And we went inside, and there's all really Paka Madhva pundits, very learned and very devoted. It was a strange mixture. Actually, Madhvacharya, he himself was very strong physically, as his fame. And he also had his brahmacharis do lots of physical exercise. So they're very strong. Healthy body helps to make a healthy mind. Cricket, that came later. But yeah.
Sometimes, one experience where I was in a party of doing heavy preaching, sankirtan like that, created lots of results. But the situation was such that whenever some practical cultivation of Brahminical qualities were there, they would become kind of destroyed due to the passionate nature of preaching.
Yeah. In preaching, actually, a lot of things, especially in the Western country, a lot of rules and regulations tend to get broken. I mean, all kinds of things. I mean, I spent yesterday for months at a time. We used to sleep on top of the book boxes. You're not supposed to sleep on top of Bhagavad Gita. We were doing it. So, especially in preaching, many of the rules, they may be altered. Just like once Prabhupada was at a program and the mic stand broke. So Allen Ginsberg, he took his shoelace and Prabhupada was disgusted. I don't want to use your shoelace to put on the mic. He took his disciple's Brahmin thread. He said, give me your Brahmin thread. He tied it up with that. Now normally you wouldn't use the Brahmin thread for any such thing, but in that circumstance he did. He didn't want to use a shoelace. Of course, that's an acharya. He can do exceptional things. But many adjustments can be made. All the time, so many adjustments are being made, especially when you're traveling, especially when you're preaching. But the thing is that in the name of time, place, and circumstance, we shouldn't alter the rules or the principle. That means that when we're preaching and doing so many things, we may adjust in so many ways. But that shouldn't become the regular standard. In other words, if you're sleeping on top of the book boxes, that doesn't mean it becomes a normal thing that you can, then you just disrespect books. As far as the passionate nature, well, maybe that's something in course of time that has to be dovetailed and purified. I'll give an example. Many years ago, Bharati Tirtha Maharaj, Ghanisham Das at that time, when I was living in England, which was in the 1970s, so his party came through. They were doing. They were going to the libraries, distributing sets of Prabhupada's books to university libraries. So he was going out all day, meeting these professors and all that. But he would every day wash all the devotees on his party their cloths. He'd be up before everyone else. He'd take their cloths and wash it. And he would every day in the Mongol Arati, he would be the one who would take the lamp and bring it round to everyone. So he was deliberately, even though he was doing such a big service, which Prabhupada personally recognized, he was deliberately cultivating the Vaishnava qualities of humility and service. So we can do that also. We can make a deliberate endeavor to cultivate that. Maybe if you spend a little time serving the Vaishnavas, you'll distribute a few less books. Maybe. Maybe you'll distribute more. If you get the blessings of the Vaishnavas. But we don't want to become one-sided. That means you're a great book distributor, but you cut your nails on top of the Bhagavad Gita. That's an extreme example. We should be all around. Be a great preacher, or be an ordinary, we're not trying to become great, we're simply trying to serve. But do our preaching, at the same time cultivate all these qualities. Do it side by side. You may be very passionate if you're distributing books in America. That may be something to do also with age. Apart from the atmosphere, the tendency is for... How old are you?
26.
Yeah, the tendency is for young men, especially in the West, but in general, not always, but generally young men tend to be quite what we would call passionate. But in course of time, it tends to decrease. And we see that people who are often very, especially devotees, that just by being in association with devotees and following the prayer, even in our youth, we may be very heavy or passionate or whatever, and it tends to become milder or mellower as we go on. So,
There are few channels on the television which show quite a lot of species of life. So,
you mean Discovery Channel?
Yes.
They show all fishes and dogs and cats and all kinds of insects and all kinds of things like that. Should we watch it? Why? What's the value? It's knowledge. We can see on TV an insect boring through a stick in the forest. It's knowledge, but it's not very useful knowledge for Krishna consciousness.
For reminding ourselves, like if we don't properly practice Krishna consciousness, then we are going to become dead.
Yeah, we can watch that to remind ourselves that if we don't properly practice Krishna consciousness, then we might become a TV star on Discovery Channel. We might be filmed as we are boring our way through a stick in the forest. So, yeah, you can do that. For 3 minutes a year or so should be enough. The rest of the reminder you can get from reading Bhagavad Gita as it is. And if you don't read Bhagavad Gita as it is, you can watch Discovery Channel day and night and you'll never know. You'll get better reminded by reading Bhagavad Gita as it is. It's a fact, sometimes a little looking at the newspaper or something, it can put into perspective all the things you read in Shastra, or just moving around in this world. But, you know, it's a tiny grain. A tiny grain can help to put everything in perspective. Otherwise, it's generally not recommended. If you get into all these things, it can just fill up your consciousness. I mean, really, if I had more time, I'd really love to read more Shastra. If I had more time, I definitely wouldn't want to waste it watching TV. I'm suffering, really. I don't read enough. If I read, I want to read Shastra. In general, TV, it's not a very good medium. It's not as good as reading or hearing. It's not as good a medium as reading or hearing. The very nature of it. TV is an addiction. It's a very bad one. I recommend don't keep a TV in your home. Your home life will be... One of my disciples, their whole family, they're devotees, some extent or other. They're one of the few families who actually followed my advice and got rid of their TV. And they told me, our home is so much better now. So much better. Otherwise, all the time the TV was on, even no one was watching it most of the time. And all the time there's this sound coming, which is just polluting. You see, even this Discovery Channel, you're all the time hearing the sound of someone who believes that life is meant for sense gratification, that we are this body, and that this world is a place for our enjoyment. Even if he's talking, you see, and now the beetle is moving over the stick, and you may think, what's wrong with that? The very sound of his voice is contaminating. Prabhupada said, this Time magazine, he said, this is very dangerous. Because if you read, it creates the impression that this material world is real. When I was living in Bangladesh, our landlord, he used to get Time and Newsweek. So he used to, Time and Newsweek, these are two famous American magazines. And he used to give them to us to read after he'd finished with them. So I used to look at them. Then after some time, I I started to think, what's going on with me? I'm starting to think that there's something very nice about America. They don't write it anywhere in Time or Newsweek. America is very nice. But it's just like in Prabhupada's books, even if it's not explicitly stated, I mean, it may be saying something like that there are three modes of material nature, or it may be stating that Lord Shiva was very angry with Daksha. So in such statements, which are in Prabhupada's books, it's not directly stated that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and we have to surrender to Him. Right? It's not directly stated. But it's implicit in every drop of ink in Prabhupada's books, and even in the white. In every word, in every speck of Prabhupada's books, it's implicitly stated that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the Supreme Enjoyer. We are not the Enjoyer. We have to surrender to Him. Prabhupada's books are very powerful. That's in every point of Prabhupada's books. So the same thing in your Time and your Newsweek and your India Today, which is the Indian equivalent of very demonic, extremely demoniac magazine. And most of the newspapers and the TV, even it may be saying something which is apparently very innocent. But in every word, it is implicitly stated. In other words, indirectly or underneath, coming from underneath, that this material world is a place of enjoyment. Enjoy it. You are the body. So it's asatsanga. It's very bad association. I also read the newspaper sometimes. Actually, recently, hardly at all, for the last quite a few months. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, if you see the newspaper, just look to see if there's anything useful for you and drop it. Not that you spend hours. So sometimes I look at the headlines and see if there's some. And sometimes you see when we're lecturing, especially to the public, it can be very, to give an example in terms of some current event, it brings the philosophy into focus for them. It helps them to realize. And another thing, sometimes if you don't know some basic things, people may think, what kind of people are these? I remember once in London, I was speaking to a guest in our temple and they mentioned the name of someone. I said, who? And he said the name again. I said, who? And it was the Prime Minister of England. I didn't know. I didn't know what his name was. And, you know, they weren't very impressed. So, you know, I was British, living in London. I didn't know who the Prime Minister, I didn't know the name of the Prime Minister. So, it's good to know some basic things. Otherwise people think you're really stupid. On the other hand, we should understand that most of what we read in the news is a lot of it's not true, or even though the so-called facts may be true to some extent, a lot of facts are suppressed, and it's presented in such a way, just like you're saying, Time and Newsweek, they're just supposed to be presenting news, but actually they're presenting a whole world view. So you have to be careful. Just like Jayadvaita Maharaj is giving this seminar on terrorism, so after this 9/11 attack, he was the first devotee I spoke to who spoke to in a sane way about this. Otherwise, I heard about this. I saw an email, the tragic events, our heart goes out. This is from a devotee. Our sympathy. And I thought, first I wondered what's going on anyway. And then I asked some devotees what's going on. They said, well, some planes flew into a building and like that. They told me. So, you know, then I got all these things were sent to me on the email and all this. And so many devotees were saying, you know, our hearts go out in sympathy and all. I was saying, well, why didn't you, you know, there are millions of animals being killed in America every year. Why don't you send out emails for sympathy, consolation? They're talking about terrorism, but America is a terrorist state. They're killing millions of animals. It wasn't just by, you know, Americans are all very good and nice, and that's, you know, it's just by bad luck that someone decided to fly an airplane into the World Trade Center. It's a karmic reaction. Of course, it's not that we say die, but we should we shouldn't be sentimental about it. And you know, they're saying we're anti-terrorist, but Erica is supporting, not only supporting, but is promoting terrorism all over the world. America supports Pakistan, which is a terrorist state, as sane people in India understand. Pakistan has, by terrorism, directly or indirectly, killed dozens of times more than the people who were killed in the World Trade Center attack. But America supports them. Why? Because it's all political motives. But we're saying, America is good. America is going to Afghanistan to stop the terrorism. We're going to stop terrorism by bombing all the farmers in Afghanistan and blowing them to pieces. This is anti-terrorism. So, you know, be careful reading all these newspapers. They're just teaching you a bunch of garbage. Really. Don't believe. Don't believe what they say. For human rights, we have to intervene. We're upholding liberty, democracy, justice. And incidentally, it's also good for our business. So really, don't, you know, TV and newspapers, they're really problematic. The thing is that people think it's true. I mean, I'm sure the journalists who write this, they think it's true. They really, I don't know, they must believe that, you know, America stands for justice and liberty. But they don't know what justice and liberty is because they're not Shastra Chakshush. Justice, how can we understand justice? According to Vedic understanding, a murderer should be killed by the king. That sounds like Islamic justice, doesn't it? They don't like that. But we have to understand everything by Shastric standards. Not by modern, liberal, humanistic, altruistic, atheistic, ignorant worldviews that come from demons like Darwin, Freud, Marx, Sartre, and all these people. We're all demons, actually. And they speak about humanism and altruism and liberalism and democracy. And what's their ultimate aim in life? To, I don't know, we don't like to say these things, but Prabhupada used to say these things. Their ultimate aim in life is to find a vagina and use it. This is how Prabhupada used to speak. To find a vagina and use it. It's all right. Don't worry. But if you see all these philosophers, there's one interesting book which one of my godbrothers recommended me to read. I looked through. It's called Intellectuals. So it gives the life story of famous, very influential intellectuals of the modern age, such as there's one playwright called Hella, some woman. And then there was some, I can't even, Norman Mailer, Bertrand Russell. He's considered such a great figure of high values. And then Sartre and all these people. But what were these people doing? If you see their the first paragraph of the book is very good. This person, Paul Johnson, he's a Christian right-wing journalist and historian who wrote this book. So he said that in traditional societies, people's actions were judged, people were judged in their behavior according to fixed standards which were given by scriptures. But in the modern age, these standards are no longer applicable, they're not accepted in society. Therefore, if anyone propounds a philosophy, we have to judge it according to the behavior of that person. What does it do to you? So this was the basis of his book. And he analyzed that Bertrand Russell, he was standing for peace, and he was an atheist and a humanist. He was a womanizer. He took one woman, used her, and dropped her. Took another, used her, dropped her. Up to the time of death. Sartre the same. He had children, he had one fixed girlfriend and many others, and he had many children. He didn't give a damn about any of his children. He never gave a a santim to any of his children. And he actually, his, because that fitted with his philosophy, existentialist, it's like, that's the base of hippieism, live here, be here now, and all this. He actually predicted that my philosophy will be used by someone at some point of time to cause to chaos in human society. And one of his students was Pol Pot, who was later to become, he's not as famous as Stalin or Hitler because he only killed Kampuchean people. He didn't kill Europeans. So, you know, Kampucheans, they're not very important. Europeans are. But he actually killed many more people than... No, he wiped out about 30% of his own country's population. Maybe about 4 million people. More than Hitler. More, he killed more Kampucheans than Hitler killed Jews. So he was a disciple of Sartre. And then, anyway, he went on all of these things. That he showed the lives of his intellectuals who were talking about democracy and humanism and altruism. But in their lives, they were dogs. What is their moral standard? Simply, they would take one woman, use, drop. Take another, use, drop. And have children and not even give a penny for them. So these, you know, don't trust all these people. If ever I hear anyone speaking about love for humankind, I immediately understand this person is a rascal. No one can have any love for humankind unless they are Krishna conscious, actually. They may say so many things, put on a good face, but actually they're only interested in exploiting others. And that's another reason, you see, why we have to follow Vaishnava culture. And it doesn't just mean not touching your hand to your mouth, but how we behave. We have to establish religious principles by our behavior. The people should see us that these people are so wonderful, I want to be like that. Why, you see, Radhanath Swami, so many people are following him. Why? Mostly all from good family. They don't have anything material to gain from him. Because he inculcates again and again and lives personally, principally, he again and again teaches Vaishnava humility, proper behavior, encourage others, see good in others, and he lives like that himself also. And hundreds of people are following him. So it's actually very powerful preaching. More than, not that we don't have philosophy must be there, but philosophy doesn't work unless we live it. And really to live as a Vaishnav, it's a great challenge, especially in this demoniac world. One thing we have to understand very clearly, that this modern society is demoniac. We really have to understand this. Now, we can take, if we see good anywhere, we can accept it and take it. But we should be very, very careful of these modern theories of being good and being nice and all this. We should be very, very careful, because unless someone understands clearly that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, he may have some idea of being good to others, but ultimately the motive of exploitation of others is going to be there. And practically we see all these, you know, they have management seminars in different companies, they're trying to teach how to be nice to others and deal with them, all this kind of thing. But actually the reality is that even in big companies, people are, they talk nicely, but actually it's all underneath. It's all envy, competition, false egoism, politics. They just, culture in the modern world means to do the nastiest things in the nicest way. That's all. Instead of being openly nasty, you'll be as nasty as, extreme nasty, but in a very nice way. Whereas real culture is that you're actually act in such a way that it's for the benefit of others, even if it may appear to them to be not very nice. We actually act for the benefit of others. So many things to be learned. You're exhausted. You want some water to drink? We should see devotees who are setting a good example and learn how to behave from them. I mean, people say I'm rough and heavy and all this kind of thing, but I was much worse previously. At some point in time, you see, I realized as I was attempting to manage and burning people out left, right, center, up, down, inside and out, that, you know, something, I was doing something wrong here. It's not working. So at that time I was working, was serving under Prabhupada Swami, and I saw that he didn't have that kind of problem. I mean, I used to be somewhat frustrated with him because I used to think he was too lenient and compromised and all this kind of thing. But on the other hand, he could get things done because even though he wasn't so strict, you know, at least people stayed with him. So at one point in time I thought I should be more like him. So I saw how he's behaving and dealing, and I tried to be more like him than what I used to be like. So I think I'm a little bit better. There's one sannyasi, one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, extremely strict and heavy, very, 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 very strong. Sometimes I used to go to his mutt. He wrote different books. Hardly anyone used to go to him. He'd always invariably chastise me, practically before I had a chance to say anything or, you know. So he was living in his mutt with his one disciple. He was an old man. I believe he had some other mutt in Calcutta with 3 or 4 disciples, but there was only one disciple could live with him. So he was very strict, but he wasn't able to, you know, bring people into Krishna consciousness. People couldn't live with him. So to understand how to balance all these things, it can be very difficult, actually. Prabhupada once said that my godbrothers are criticizing me that you're allowing women to live in the ashrams and this and that. But he said, Prabhupada said that for all their strictness, they're not able to do anything to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. So how to understand all these things? Well, that requires some intelligence. I'm still trying to understand myself. But in the meantime, we have to try and teach, just like someone, you know, there's the professor and there are some students in the second grade and some students in the first grade. So the students in the second grade can start to teach whatever little they know more to students in the first grade.